For many Americans, the image of private military contractors in Iraq has been shaped by the fatal shooting of 17 Iraqi civilians last year by employees of Blackwater Worldwide, which had been engaged by the State Department to protect diplomatic personnel. That incident is now the subject of a grand jury investigation in Washington. For years, contractors held immunity from prosecution in Iraq, but that's likely to change as the United States and Iraq negotiate a new security agreement. My guest, John Geddes, worked for years as a military contractor in Iraq, usually providing security for business people and journalists as they traveled about the country and held meetings or covered stories. Geddes is a former British paratrooper who saw action in the Falklands and other conflicts. He says his operation was very different from large American firms like Blackwater. Geddes says he did his best to maintain friendly relations with Iraqis. He kept a low profile and tried to keep his clients, many of them TV journalists, out of dangerous situations. But that wasn't always possible. Geddes carried an AK-47 and fired it more than once to defend his charges. He's written a book about his experiences called Highway to Hell, Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq. Well, John Geddes, welcome to Fresh Air. Besides escorting crews while they're actually shooting news stories, you often had to transport them hundreds of miles. And you tell a harrowing story of taking a news crew from Jordan to Baghdad, I believe. And as you were out there on the open road, a car pulled out and obviously had menacing intentions. It looked like they wanted to perhaps kidnap your crew. What happened?
I picked up a couple of what I call combat indicators, Dave, which is, you know, changes in the atmosphere. Vehicles were starting to pull away, slow down, move away from us. And then this 7 Series pulled up to the rear. It was a black vehicle, blacked out windows. And it was pretty obvious that they meant some kind of derogatory business. Pulled up, the left side window pulled down, and out came an AK-47, put a burst of fire across the front of the vehicle.
Across your vehicle, right?
Yeah, across the bonnet, clipped the light, and obviously with the intention of pulling us over.
So when they fire at the vehicle and or across the front of the vehicle, does your driver slow down, speed up? What do you want him to do at that moment?
Well, previously to that, the crew, after a heavy night of drinking in Jordan, in the Intercontinental, the crew were asleep in the back prior to the gunshots. As soon as they opened up, the driver started slowing down.
Your driver,
I
you
told
mean?
Him, yeah. I told him in no uncertain terms with a few expletives, put your foot down and go. So we carried on. They dropped back momentarily, came back, and both sides of the windows were rolled down, and two AK-47s were pointed at the vehicle at point-blank range at this stage. I had an AK-47 on my lap and pulled the trigger and fired into their vehicle before they had a chance to take us out.
And what was the effect of your fire?
Well, it was close quarter. I didn't hang around to find out what damage had occurred, but a burst of armor-piercing rounds at close quarter would cause considerable damage. The car started to fishtail, and I pulled away.
And you fired through your own door, is that right?
Fired through the own door to maintain the element of surprise. Otherwise, as soon as they saw that weapon, we'd have been dead.
How do you feel after an encounter like that?
Pretty shocked. I think, I'm an experienced guy, so it didn't upset me too much initially. It's later on in the day when things unwind that you get a bit of post-trauma stress and need a couple of Jack Daniels at the time to sort my head out. But at the time, I looked back to the crew, who were now awake by this time, and said, you know, welcome to Fallujah.
Oh, boy. And they continued on their way and did their business.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that happens when you're escorting news crews around is that you have to deal with their interest in being aggressive and getting the great camera shot and balancing that against your imperative, which is to keep them safe. How do you deal with that? I mean, were there occasions when camera people wanted to do things that you thought were simply too hazardous or which you accommodated them but worried if you'd let them go too far?
You know, they've got their task, they have their job to do, and the sort of working parameters of that are very delicate. You know, like you say, Dave, there has to be a balance brought where you can successfully protect a client and they can get their story. So when a journalist looks through, or a cameraman looks through a camera, that's all he can see is through that lens. He doesn't see anything behind him, to the left or right, and he's completely unaware of what's going on around him. Having a security guy there or girl gives him the opportunity to literally watch his back and flanks while they get on with their job. But even then, they try and push the parameters.
One of the things you write about in the book is that there was a difference between the British and American contractors' approach to moving around, getting from point A to point B safely in a dangerous environment. How would you describe the difference?
The main difference is the American PSDs.
That's the private security detail?
Yeah. Yeah. They have a particular method of operation. They've got a particular way they dress and the vehicles they use. I think it's sort of State Department rules and regulations that they have to abide by, and they will travel in Humvees, and they virtually wear everything, even down to the weapon scales of the U.S. Army. But they wear one color camouflage, and instead of disruptive pattern material. That's the only overtly physical difference. So they'll travel looking, by all intents and purposes, as a military convoy, whereas we travel as a civilian convoy, civilian vehicles, 4x4s, sometimes armored, sometimes not, and communicate as much as we can with the locals, and try and reduce the risk to the client.
You say that you like to travel low profile. The expression is jingly jangly. What does that mean?
Well, it's traveling in low profile, sort of saloon cars that are adapted for, you know, high speed. They're sometimes armored, sometimes not, and the vehicles are dressed to look like everybody else on the highway, so they look like the locals.
Did you say saloon cars?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, sedans.
Ah. So what does that mean? Odd mismatched paints, some scratches and nicks
yeah.
in the fenders?
Yeah. So no matter what vehicle you're using, whether it's a sedan or a 4x4, then it's, you know, it's not clean on the outside. It's a bit scratched, a bit battered, but mechanically sound, so it can make a quick getaway in the event of a problem. And concealed weapons rather than the vehicle bristling with weapons. So from a distance, you're like everybody else. So you travel from A to B in not truly undercover, but low profile.
You describe one trip that you took from Baghdad to Jordan, at which the night before you were to leave, a number of folks in the hotel bar found out you were going, and you agreed to bring them along. There were some Japanese tourists and I think a couple of Israeli businessmen, and you agreed to let them ride along with your convoy if they kept up at no charge. And off you go barreling down the road with the Israelis in the rear. They fall behind and sure enough get into trouble. What happens?
They wanted to get back to Jordan. The way they got in was by taxi, and they just didn't want to go back by taxi. The mood of the Fallujah road had changed, as it did on a daily basis. Sometimes it was fairly safe to travel up the road. This day, it wasn't. The intelligence came back that, you know, could be a few problems on the highway. Intelligence reports from the American authorities, from the locals, from the drivers, from the interpreters said, you know, it's not a good day to be on the Fallujah road.
Mm-hmm. But you're out there anyway, right? And
but we're out there anyway. It's you know, at that time it was running a gauntlet. So the Israelis had asked me to come along. I did attempt to sort of charge them a fee, but you know, at the time I was sort of drinking quite a lot of Jack Daniels and Diet Coke at the time, and at the end of the evening, you know, decided to let them travel on the cavalcade the next morning that was quite quickly growing.
So here you are. You're bombing along this road at high speed with an AK-47 and a hangover and trying to hope all these vehicles stay together. And you notice that these two Israeli businessmen are not keeping up the pace. They fall behind. And then what happens?
Well, they fell behind. They got pulled over. And
pulled over by whom, do you know?
Pulled over by bandits, probably bandits. I say in my book, Baathist, bandit, insurgents, who knows, you know. But they were pulled over by armed men and quickly sort of subjected to conditioning. In other words, thrown out the vehicle, thrown on the floor and being searched. Obviously find out their identity, see if they're worth anything. Do they have anything? Take the vehicle, maybe hostages, etc. And the deal was the night before, you know, if anybody falls behind, you know, that's it.
But you didn't just let them go. What did you do?
We pulled over. I got to the back of the vehicle, the offside. I got everybody in a ditch. Got my AK out with the tripod in front of the weapon. Put that down. Had a nice sort of fairly accurate x15 sight on there, and put down a couple of rounds to persuade the aggressors to think again.
Now, when you pulled over, how far away were you from the point where these two Israelis were being captured by these guys?
I think it was probably about 200 meters.
And did the bandits or insurgents, whoever they were, did they realize that you had pulled over and were taking aim at them?
No. It was too much traffic. They didn't know at that time. We were just part of the traffic at that point. It was very heavy traffic at that time.
So how many of them were there, and what did your fire result in?
I identified two, and as far as I could see, I hit at least one of them, and created enough diversion for the second guy to get in his vehicle, which gave the opportunity for the Israelis to extract.
If you're just joining us, our guest is John Geddes. He worked as a military contractor in Iraq. He's written a book called Highway to Hell, Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq. You know, you've described a couple of occasions where you shot and hit Iraqis, probably killed some. What legal consequences, if any, would you face for having shot an Iraqi?
That's quite a question, Dave.
Well, on the occasions when you did fire at someone, did you simply move on? I mean, it was obviously situations of hostile fire. I mean, it wasn't like this was a civilian dispute. Hmm. What were the laws that governed hostilities between private contractors and Iraqis?
Well, the laws that govern sort of private contractors aren't. It's pretty much a gray area. You know, the companies that operate. They have their own. Particularly the British ones. They have their own sort of set code of conduct. They have orders for opening fire, and basically they operate within British Army rules of engagement, not legally but morally, if you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. They're all ex-soldiers, and that's their the standard they work to, and that's the sort of criteria of their standard operating procedures. But as far as accounting for action, there is no authority even today to answer to.
Well, of course, I mean, the incident that is most widely known was September of last year when the American company Blackwater Worldwide had this shootout in a Baghdad traffic circle and killed 17 civilians. And there's an American grand jury looking into that. And as the United States negotiates a new security agreement with Iraq, what I've read is that the immunity that in effect has governed contractors will be removed, but it's not so clear what the rules will be. Was it simply unclear what rules, if any, governed your contact with Iraqis then?
Well, it was at that time, it was the law of the gun, really. I was defending myself. I was defending people around me, and against armed insurgents or armed bandits or whoever they are, being paid to transport people from A to B. Working within my own moral parameters, I can, you know, honestly say that I never fired my weapon without good reason.
You know, you've spent a life in the military and saw action in a lot of places before you became a private contractor. Why did you do what you did in Iraq? Is it the adventure? Is it the money?
Initially, it was the adventure. It's I mean, that's a soldier's lot. That's why people become soldiers, to work in that environment and ultimately go to war. And there's a certain amount of institutionalization that takes place when you spend so much time with the military. And when it's time to leave, it's a hard transition into civilian life. I found it quite easy until Gulf War II and the sort of specter of the private security company in hostile environments became evident and big business. I just felt I had to get out there to experience the job. More money was pretty secondary, and find out myself what was going on.
You know, pilots in World War II used to, if I know the story correctly, used to have so many missions that they would fly and would look forward to finishing that number of missions, because they knew that the more missions they flew, the longer the odds were that they would go home safely. Do you feel like you've had enough of getting out there and risking your neck, or is that something you want to continue to do?
It's a question I ask myself all the time. It is a law of averages. It is Russian roulette, especially on the streets of Iraq. But it's the way I rationalize it is, you know, if you take a year out, then the credits are back in the box, and you can go out there and do some more.
So you think you'll be back out there with an AK-47 and in a
most,
in a big
most
vehicle
definitely
again?
At some point.
Yeah,
most definitely.
Well, John Geddes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Geddes' memoir is called "Highway to Hell: Dispatches from a Mercenary in Iraq." You can read an excerpt of the book at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.